Nur. The good thing about having all her meetings cancelled and everyone being confined to their offices, Nur reflects, is that it leaves her at leisure to sit by the window of her own office with a cup of tea, waiting for O. Levy to come out. A few hours go by. Nobody passes the window. The light moves slowly across the lawn. Nur falls into an awake-asleep state. Her tea sends up distress signals into the air next to her as it cools. When something finally happens, Nur jumps. O. Levy has come out of reception, flanked by Clifford Burns' squad of specialized whatevers, and is walking towards one of the black cars that's waiting there for him. He looks young, from what Nur can see of him. First May, then this boy, another kid. Nur gets up and puts her face close to the glass. The thin view between two shutters expands. She watches the man stop, facing away from her, and look at the trees circling the grounds. He turns towards the gates and looks at them, then the car park. Then he completes a full revolution and faces the clinic. He looks like he's never seen a building before, and now, having seen one, it's more beautiful than he could possibly have imagined. His eyes travel over the place where Nur stands, without penetrating beyond the glass. An odd feeling. Seen, yet not seen. With his face upturned, Nur can see him now clearly. He is really quite extraordinarily good-looking. Older than she first thought, too. More like late 20s. It's only his manner that made him seem younger. Where May was closed and wary, this man looks as if he's been opened out. In anyone else, that look of wonder could have seemed fey, but this is convincing. Then the men escorting O. Levy gather around him, subtly pressing him in the direction of the open car door, blocking Noor's view, and when they move out and away, the car door is closed and the man is gone. And Nur has to wonder, what the fuck? But that's that. Nur's going to have to go home that night without knowing what the fuck. Chances of ever finding out what the fuck are decreasing by the minute, she realizes. She might live out the rest of her life, years and years of it, and die without ever knowing what the actual fuck. Of course, she does have another option. She could tell senior management, or even the media or police, what Louise has been doing, which might, in the resulting catastrophic mess, throw up a few insights. But Nur, for various reasons, not least of which is the fact that she herself has personally signed off on every single one of Louise's illegal activities, would rather not. Rasa, Nur thinks. Then it comes to her. Not Rasa, but Rasa, as in tabula rasa. A blank, a complete erasure. Nur remembers what Louise said when she was here with Clifford, something about large amounts of memory being lost. Louise said later that she was talking about people with head injuries, but Nur wonders now if this was another lie. Because what did Total Wipeout 73 experience? Well, a total wipeout. Maybe Martin Noy was another person who'd developed memory loss as a result of a botched procedure. What if Rasa is a code word for procedures that went wrong somehow and had to be covered up? Nur gets up and goes out into the hall, crowded with newly released Nepenthe staff, noisily excited to be out of their offices, steering a path through them, shutting down attempts at small talk until she arrives at Dr. Carini de Oliveira's door. Hi, Karini, Noor says. How's it going? Karini looks up. She seems surprised to see Noor, but not unwelcoming. Karini's office is very different to Noor's. It has about 30 more plants in it for a start. It also smells faintly of something that Noor suspects, with a shudder, to be burnt sage. I'm not interrupting anything, am I? Noor says. Oh, no, Karini says. I like to have a brief meditation session after I see each client, but that's over. What can I help you with? As normal operations have been suspended, I'm running errands, Noor says. Clifford, you know. She hasn't actually said Clifford is the one who tasked her with this. Noor is the one who set the errand. Then, in an unconnected sentence, she said Clifford's name. So, not a lie. Right, Clifford, says Karini. For a moment, she looks somewhat less spiritual. Noor even thinks she sees a tiny eye roll, but maybe she's imagining it. Have you received the notes yet for the Raza client? Noor says. Mr. Levy, he just left. Yes, Karini says. Thanks. I didn't realize you were on the Raza program. Communication round here, right? Noor says. Not a lie. Karini laughs. Well, that's all. Thanks, Noor says. I'll speak to Louise and Clifford. Not a lie. Dr. Nightingale? Is she on Raza? I thought she was very anti the whole thing, which is understandable. Oh, totally, Noor says. She should just know that the clinic is open again. I don't think anyone's been keeping her in the loop either. Not a lie. Sounds like you have a fun day ahead of you, Karini says. Right, says Noor. If they work out how to use their mobile phones, I'll be obsolete. See you later, Karini. So there's an answer. Raza is definitely something shady. The access denied clients are Raza clients. But this has nothing, apparently, to do with Louise. So, not a very satisfying answer. That night, Noor doesn't take her sleeping pills. She doesn't sleep. She thinks about Louise. She thinks about Eleanor. She thinks about Captain Kirk and Clementine, Orlando Palladino, dipped in the silent water. Tell me a story, she thinks. No, not good enough. Tell me an ending. She knows what a happy ending is now. A happy ending is an answer. It doesn't even have to be a happy answer. Just something that allows the book to be closed so that everyone can move on with their lives. At about midnight, Noor's startled by a loud noise from outside. A sharp bang. Two hard surfaces suddenly brought together. She goes to the window and looks out. The girl from the next door garden flat is walking unsteadily up her drive. Behind her, a wheelie bin lies on its side. Noor hasn't seen the girl or her boyfriend since last week. After a weekend with no music or voices or smoke or laughing or breaking of glasses, she'd assumed they were away, bothering someone else's neighbours. She looks at the girl, curiously. Noor's always thought of her as a happy, noisy drunk, but that's not in evidence tonight. The girl is wrapped in a large hooded jumper, pulled up over her nose. Above it, her eyes are negatively haloed in a glistening black, smudged down onto her cheeks. There's something about her expression that Noor recognizes, the same thing she noticed before, when she was reminded of Eleanor. Like the girl knew all along that the secret of life is that it's shit and unfair, But she laughed and talked and smiled anyway, and now she's decided that there's no point fighting it anymore. Noor remembers the way Eleanor looked at her before she turned and left Noor's flat, and Noor shut the door firmly behind her. Of course, her look had said. What else was it ever going to be? The girl outside stumbles and falls onto her knees. Noor winces, reflexively. The girl doesn't get up immediately, despite Noor willing her to. She just sits there, on what must be the freezing paving of the drive, her arms wrapped round her knees. Okay, Noor says to the girl. I'm coming. She puts on a coat and boots over her pajamas and goes outside. The girl doesn't look up as Noor approaches, insulated as she must be by alcohol, by misery. She only looks up once Noor is basically standing over her. Her expression is like a closed door. The inside of Noor's newly closed door, vibrating minutely on its hinges. What's her name? Nina? Hey, Nina, Noor says. She isn't sure what to say. You can't sit out here. She means it to sound gentle, but it doesn't come out that way. She tries to think of something softer, but it doesn't matter. The girl seems to be far beyond tone. She turns her face up, not trying to wipe her eyes or her running nose, and Noor's not even sure the girl really sees her. A gust of alcohol comes off her, hot in the icy air. Where's your boyfriend? Noor asks. Shall I get him? Gone, the girl says. Gone? When is he coming back? Please, she thinks, let him arrive and deal with this. Shall I call him for you? The girl doesn't just look drunk. She looks ill. Possibly she's about to throw up. Noor can't help herself. She moves away from the girl, eyeing the wavering, unpredictable edges of her mouth. Coming back, repeats the girl, wonderingly. Back? No, not coming back. What? Why not? Noor asks. We met. We slept together. Then we found out. Then we deleted it. Then we met again. We've been living together. Living together. Then we got the memory back. The girl suddenly focuses on her. As if the sight of Noor has roused her, she gets, surprisingly quickly, to her feet. You, she says. You work at the clinic. Yes, Noor says. You shouldn't have let us in the first place, the girl says. She sounds almost angry now, an anger fighting its way up through the wet weight of booze and tears. Shouldn't have let us delete it. Delete what? Noor asks. The girl seems very close again. Noor steps back into the flower bed. But the anger, if that's what it was, never breaks the surface. The girl is crying. She sways towards Noor. How can? She says. Then something incomprehensible. She sways again, her eyes fixed on Noor, as if her question is skewing her own gravity. Noor puts out an arm to steady her and to hold her away. What? Noor says. Something of the girl's fright has got into her. She doesn't want to hear the answer, but she asks again anyway. What did you delete?
He's my brother, the girl says. My brother. Brother.
Then she shakes off Noor's arm. Noor incapable of letting go or holding tighter or moving at all, and walks unsteadily into her own flat. Noor goes to bed in a daze. She gets up the next day in the same daze, unreset by sleep. She doesn't see her neighbor as she goes outside to her car. She stands the bin back up and drives to work. The fog doesn't break until Noor gets into the empty kitchen at Nepenthe. She stands in the familiar space and feels at last like she's woken up. Not into anything good. She feels suddenly dizzy. She leans on the worktop and puts her head in her hands. Her fingers are so cold against the skin of her forehead that she flinches. She thinks of the girl saying, "You shouldn't have let us." But that was just wrong. The girl was upset. Nepenthe couldn't be responsible for. The girl was right. It's all out of control. What is Noor a part of? Something doing damage, harm spreading out across the world, each harm dividing and multiplying. People are booking restorations every day. People still want deletions. The clinic doesn't care, she thinks. The clinic rolls on, gathering money. Someone in pain extends a hand and Nepenthe plucks the cash out of it. Sometimes their interventions make people better, sometimes they make them worse, sometimes they destroy them. Her fingers press into the skin of her forehead. There's no order, there's no system, it's chaos, and Louise. Noor thought Louise at least was administering her philosophy of least harm, protecting the ideals of health, of sanity, guarding the sanctuary doors against the painful confusion of the world. But there is no sanctuary, and Louise is playing both sides anyway, order and confusion. That's when it comes back to Noor what May said the other day about her dad being on the payroll. Not a joke, then, from Alistair. Louise really was the one who made the money. For as long as Noor has known her, in fact, Louise has been making a lot of money. Enough to pay for the Japanese-inspired house, the perfume, the Tesla, the art, the overseas property. So where does money like that come from? Not from mentally ill, access-denied patients, obviously. Money like that comes from important executives in the arms and energy industries, rich housewives, solicitors, fraudsters. Maybe it doesn't come from the people themselves, but from people around them. Oh God, she says. She Googles Guy Cazalet, Eleanor's old boss. Her mind is ahead of the search results. When they come back with his history, missing links, dodgy connections, accounting discrepancies and fraud allegations at his chain of casinos and bars, she isn't even surprised. He'd been stabbed on the street in Rome a year before the helicopter crash. A mugging gone wrong, apparently. He was in intensive care for weeks. What did Eleanor say? Oh, and Nepenthe's screening processes are, of course, totally irreproachable. She didn't seem all that amazing to me. Noor puts her phone away. She thinks of her dreams when she arrived. A straightening, a streamlining, a brightening of people's minds, a doing of good, a making of sense. She thought she and Louise were going to do it together. She thinks of May saying, "I'm done with her." She closes her eyes. Tiredness and sickness, anger and panic make her head swim. When she opens her eyes again, Louise is standing in front of her. "Morning, Noor," says Louise. Louise looks almost beatifically calm. Her hair is in perfect order. She looks like she's had plenty of sleep. Noor stands up straight. She tries to look equally calm and at ease. Then she thinks, bugger that. There's not even the slightest chance Louise is going to be fooled. Louise can probably tell right now that even Noor's attempt to stand up straight is shaky. Noor's legs don't feel like her usual legs, that's the problem. Like some trick has been played, her good solid legs swapped for a pair made of rubber. "Hi," Noor says, doing her best Noor impression. You're a day late. Everything important and secret happened yesterday. Why are you here? Noor is thinking. Why? Why? But she knows. Today's appointment is M. O'Connor. This must be the person Louise is after.
I heard, Louise said.
Are you okay? You look, well, bloody awful?
Yeah.
I tried to get a natural night's sleep. Terrible decision.
Agreed, Louise says. Drugs are the answer. Nature had her chance and she fucked it up, right?
Noor thinks about Louise writing May a prescription for antidepressants. So, she says, what was all that confidential stuff yesterday? Can you tell me?
I would, Louise says. You know I would, but I can't.
Guess we'll have to wait for the impending court case, Noor says.
Given how poor Nepenthe is at burying bad news, I'm sure you won't be waiting long.
Louise smiles at her. You know, Cliff was asking me about you. He remembered your name, which is unusual. Seems you impressed him yesterday. It occurs to Noor that Louise is pretending to be Louise as much as Noor is pretending to be Noor.
I was rude to him, Noor says. He chose to take it as a joke. He'll probably want to promote you now. And not that I like agreeing with Cliff, but that is something we should discuss again. It's long overdue. Anyway, were you on the way to your office? Do you mind helping me with something?
Sure, Noor says. But is it urgent? Louise hesitates. Then she waves her hand and smiles. The smile is bright, wide, and brief, as if Louise knows it wouldn't stand much scrutiny.
No, no, she says. Not at all.
Oh, great, Noor says. I meant to stop in and speak to Jim Stokes, probably about yesterday. It won't take long, and then I'll be back down with you.
Perfect. I'll be here most of the day. We can have lunch.
Great, Noor says.
Noor leaves the kitchen and takes the stairs that lead to Jim's office. On the first story, there's a recessed windowsill. She puts her tea on the floor, already knowing that this is goodbye, and sits on the sill, her back against the wall. The rubbery feeling has expanded, crept from her legs up through the rest of her body. Noor holds her phone in her rubbery hand. She calls Clifford Byrne. She's put through quickly. Not because he recognizes her name. He doesn't, despite Louise's claims, and Noor has to explain twice who she is. But probably because she says the words urgent, misconduct, and security breach to his secretary. And even once Noor has filled Clifford Byrne in on what Louise has been doing, looking up clients and calling them, presumably to convince them not to have restorations, he seems, if anything, somewhat baffled.
Phew, he says. Well, and you say that you will be implicated. You co-authorized this malpractice, whatever it was, and you're doing this because it's the right thing to do. Okay, no, that's a good enough reason. All right, then.
Okay, says Noor.
Is there anything else?
Yes, actually.
Okay, says Clifford Byrne.
He sighs.
What else?
I heard about something called Raza. Clifford Byrne interrupts her.
Where did you hear about that?
A former client said it, Noor says. A protester.
I don't even know what Raza is. Okay, Clifford Byrne says. Well, Nora, forget what was said. It's all above board, obviously. But it is confidential.
Yeah, Nora says. I'd got that impression.
Right, Clifford Byrne says. So, that's everything.
You tell me, Nora says. What do I do now?
Oh, nothing, says Clifford.
He sounds almost cheerful. It makes Nora feel uneasy.
There's due process now. Thank you for telling me, Nora. We'll take it from here.
Oh, Nora says. Okay. And that's it. The conversation seems to end very quickly. Nora finds herself faced with the prospect of going back downstairs. She stays wedged into the window for a little longer, her adrenaline sputtering, dying. Eventually, she hears a door open further along the corridor. Footsteps approach. She has to get up and walk down the stairs. It's fine, she thinks. She'll just go down to her office and explain to Louise that the meeting with Jim took longer than she thought, and she doesn't have time to sign off on anything for her right now. Louise will be pissed off, but there won't be much she can say. Obviously, further down the line, she'll work out that Nora has betrayed her and be really pissed off, but she'll be back in London by then. Nora can hear voices as she approaches her office. Jim is one, Louise is another. As she rounds the corner, she sees the two of them standing outside her own office door with two security guards. I'm your boss, Louise is saying to Jim. You don't have the authority. Jim says. This hasn't come from me. Clifford Byrne called. You've been denied security clearance. What? What the hell is going on? That's all I know. You need to go back to London and speak to him. Nora, Louise says, as Nora approaches. She looks relieved to see her. Clearly nobody has told her that Nora is responsible for the denial of her security clearance. Nora goes over to them, feeling something rotten turn and flop inside her. Perhaps it's her stomach. Or it could be the heart. Something rotten anyway, in the state of Nora. I need to speak to Nora, Louise says to Jim. Give me a few minutes. Jim says.
I'm not going to take her hostage, for fuck's sake, Louise says. You and these two gentlemen can stay right here, in the corridor. You won't get in any trouble.
Say no, thinks Nora.
Okay, says Jim. But just a couple of minutes.
He and the security guards retreat a few feet away, where they stand, in silence, looking rather foolish. Louise takes Noor's arm. She leans in. Her perfume surrounds Noor. It feels as if it's in Noor's mouth.
Listen, Louise says. This is important. I have to speak to a client. I can't explain why, but it's urgent. I need you to get me some information, privately. I'll explain later.
You want me to illegally access a client file so that you can illegally contact them? Nora says.
Yes, I know you can do it. You're good with computers. You can cover your tracks, can't you? I need to stop something. I need to protect someone, a client. It's going to be disastrous. Trust me, Nora.
Up close, Nora can see that Louise's forehead is shining with sweat. She removes her arm from Louise's grip.
But I don't trust you, she says.
I think the only thing you care about protecting is your cash flow. There's a silence. It feels long and painful. It's like all the air is being pressed out of Nora. If the silence goes on too long, she'll have no breath left. Her anger has gone too. It can't hold her up. She'll fall on the floor and Louise will stop looking stunned and become furious and will step on her head or kick her in the ribs. And Nora will accept it.
I see,
Louise says.
You told them.
And Noor says, yes. Louise takes a breath in. Now, finally, she looks angry. Noor has no idea why this comes as a relief. That's a lie. Noor does know why. She needs Louise to behave like a villain so that Noor knows she definitely is one. Villains, when they get caught, shout and rage and vow revenge and say they'd have got away with it if it hadn't been for those pesky kids. They don't stand quietly and look shocked, and worse, betrayed. Say something villainous, she begs Louise. You absolute fucking idiot, Louise says. Thank you, thinks Noor. But why did you do that? Why couldn't you have come to me first? Louise says. Slightly off script, but Noor decides to ignore that. She's full of her own righteous outrage now. She says, because you involved me in gross misconduct and fraud. You lied to me. Your own daughter warned me about you. She didn't trust you either. Louise opens her mouth. Then she closes it again. There are tears in her eyes. Noor's hands are trembling. You fucking idiot, Louise says again, but it lacks conviction. You fraud, says Noor, also lacking in conviction. At this, Louise shrugs. The tears, if they were ever imminent, are gone. Behind them, Jim Stokes coughs. Oh, for God's sake, Louise says to him. She turns round. Lurking in the corner, coughing. You're not standing in a line behind a queue jumper. You're the clinic director. Grow up and throw me out properly. Throw you out? Asks Jim. Yes, this conversation is over. I'm ready to go. Wait, what were you even doing? Noor asks her. Louise looks genuinely startled. You don't know? She says. She looks at Noor as if she's so bowled over by Noor's stupidity that she can only marvel at it in silence. Then she gives one of her angry laughs. You'll find out, she says. She beckons the security guards. Come on, aren't you going to handcuff me or something?
No, says one. We're just meant to see you off the premises.
Fine, Louise says. She doesn't look at Noor. She turns round and walks away, and Jim Stokes and the security guards have no choice but to hurry after her. After a moment, they all disappear around the curve of the corridor. Silence descends. Noor feels right. Yes, what she did was right. She thinks of Louise calling her a fucking idiot. It makes her feel better. She also feels terrible. But she assumes that will pass. Noor waits a few minutes, then goes into reception. Marie is at her desk and Jim at the window. Neither of them are looking at each other or speaking. The white space is full of held-in shock. Noor goes to the window to stand beside Jim, and the three of them watch as Louise's car pulls out of the gates and disappears. What the hell was that? Jim asks her. What? I get a call from Clifford Byrne saying I have to get Louise out of the clinic and send her to see him. Do whatever is necessary. He looks upset. What would I have done if she'd resisted? I don't know, Noor says. Got her in a headlock? Fended her off with a chair? This is funny to you, Jim says. Not especially, Noor says. She sighs. She's about to explain to Jim that... But what can she explain?
Nothing.
She's going to have to stay silent, because whatever she does and says now is going to be thought about later as that stuff Noor said when she was trying to get herself off the hook. Let it go on the record that Noor said nothing, she thinks. I'm going out, she says to Jim, for a walk. Jim looks surprised. Before he can think of what to say in response, she's through the door. And then, she thinks, Dr. Ali just walked out, which was an admission of complicity if I ever saw one. Never mind. She can hear the protesters now, just about. They're quiet, caught between protests. She can hear the pigeons cooing more loudly, the hoarse hum of the passing cars, a security guard with a pot belly talking on his phone as if it's a special forces walkie-talkie. All clear, he's saying. All clear. Noor walks round the clinic to the back of the building. Here, there is an unlovely secret corridor of air conditioning vents and a concrete path tufted with untrimmed grass, leading to the gravelled area where laundry vans and bin collectors pull in. She used to smoke there, once upon a time, before Louise saw her one afternoon and said, "You ought to stop doing that, you know." Noor wishes she had a cigarette now. Eleanor wasn't in love with her boss, Noor thought. Those weren't the circumstances. Eleanor was a witness, a victim. The only one who had an unhealthy relationship with her boss was Noor. Noor's first day at Nepenthe. Here she is, new suit, with two stubborn pieces of hair getting out of their ponytail and curling above each ear like two apostrophes. Here is Louise, her own hair in a perfect bob. What is Noor saying? I want to change lives. Change lives? Asked Louise. She looked amused. Or restore meaning to people's lives. Improve quality of life. Well, those are three different things. I'm sorry? You talk about them as if they're synonymous, but they're not. Take meaning. If you ask somebody what gives their life meaning, they'll probably say it's family or work, maybe some kind of religious or ethical crusade. They choose a narrative thread, and after a while they convince themselves that they didn't choose it at all. And that's how people make life make sense. Oh, said Noor. She thought, I've blown it. But then Louise smiled at her. She said, and it's our job, we psychologists, to play along. Our, thought Noor. We. Noor doesn't take her sleeping pill again that night. She allows herself to lie in bed and think about Eleanor, about Louise saying, you fucking idiot, about Eleanor, about her neighbor crying on the step, about Eleanor. She turns over in bed. Ask one question and the rest come in behind it. What did Louise actually do? Does wiping a note change the rest of the symphony? Who is O. Levy? Did Captain Kirk ever dream of Raina? Was Louise ever Noor's friend, really? Can love change you as a person? Can that change be undone if the memory of love is undone? If Noor erased that last argument with Eleanor, would it give her peace? If she thought their relationship had ended with Eleanor leaving without warning and never coming back? At that point, Noor had just assumed Eleanor hadn't loved her, and Noor could get over it, because what was there to get over? The problem was that she'd seen it in Eleanor's eyes when she came back to Noor's door. Love.
before it got chased off by hurt and anger, and finally that weary, fatalistic look, that of course. If Noor forgot that day, she'd forget that Eleanor had loved her, meaning nothing to hold on to, meaning letting the idea of Eleanor go, Noor going back to how she was before, if not contented exactly, at least calm, stable, functioning, a factory reset. Would that work? Is there such a thing as Nepenthe, as Homer and Poe and Spock meant it? The theory, the dream. Noor knows all the questions now.